We'll call the meeting to order.
We're not recording.
Okay. We'll call the Pension Commission meeting to order. Good evening. We have three sets of minutes from previous meetings that need to be adopted, two from this year and one from last year. Would someone care to move those minutes? Senator Pappas moves at those minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Representative Rukavina, Representative Smith has another committee hearing that's going on right now. Would you mind if we took his first and then you'll be second?
Mr. Chair, since he's on the committee and will determine the outcome of mine, I'm gladly to step in.
Representative, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Members, we're hearing six bills this evening, and the plan is for us to lay these over for possible inclusion in our mini omnibus pension bill. And as you know, we have set a meeting for next Wednesday, the 11th, and the possibility of another one on the 12th. And we've also communicated that we're trying to check to see if we could meet on the 16th, the evening of Monday the 16th. And the thought would be that would be the meeting at which time we would finally act on a mini omnibus pension bill. So with that, we'll place under consideration right now Representative Smith's bill that has a number now, I guess. I don't know what the number is, but Representative Smith, welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. This is a bill for a constituent, and I guess I would like Mr. Martin to walk through the summary, if you would.
Okay, Mr. Martin.
Members, this bill relates to the teachers, our retirement association. It has to do with a program that allows teachers to.
This relates to TRA, the statewide teachers, our retirement association, and it also deals with a program, the part-time teacher, part-time teaching, full-time service program within TRA. It's a program that's been around since about 1977 or 78. In this case, the teacher was part of the program for several years, and for whatever reason, the agreement to participate in this program for the 2008-2009 school year was not sent to TRA in a timely fashion. Hence, she receives only 80% of the salary that she would normally have, and this lands right about in the middle of her probable high five. So the bill permits a particular teacher, Deborah Cooper, to purchase with the payment of her equivalent member contributions plus interest for the 20% of salary that was not covered because she was not regularly part of the program. It also requires the Hopkins School District to pay the balance of the full actuarial value of the benefit she obtains by purchasing the extra salary credit. Ms. Cooper, by virtue of teaching 80% of full time, gets a full year of service credit. So what she's really missing here is salary credit, and the salary credit lands within the time that determines her pension benefit. So that's the benefit that she obtains. The payment deadline for the member is July 1, 2012, and the special legislation would expire a month later. We do raise policy issues with service credit purchases. They tend to follow the same format, which is the conformity with the general policy of the Pension Commission, which is, if you look on page 2 of the memo, we quote from the policy principles of the Pension Commission that essentially it's public employment or the functional equivalent of public employment in order to be a service or salary credit purchase. The purchase has got to have a combination that will match the liability that the pension fund is taking on by enacting the special legislation. That the purchase payment has a minimum payment by the member of their equivalent member contributions plus interest, unless the employer committed a particularly egregious error. The purchase payment is the responsibility of the member, and the employer payment would be required if there is employer culpability, and the purchase must not violate notions of equity. There doesn't seem to be any equitable issues here. It doesn't seem to, from what limited facts I have, that there was any lack of diligence on the part of the teacher. But if Hopkins School District does want to raise the issue, it would be appropriate to take testimony from them. The bill provides for the full actuarial value purchase payment amount. TRA had not yet provided me an estimate of what that would be, and it would be appropriate to have TRA testify as to the amount of the member contribution and the full actuarial value balance that's due from Hopkins. Then the last item is precedent. Is there any precedent that exists for doing this kind of legislation, and to what extent would this kind of legislation, if enacted, provide an adverse precedent for future special legislation? There have been a number of service credit purchases or salary credit purchases related to the part-time teaching service credit program, so that this does not break new ground, and there's no reason to believe that doing this one additional time would constitute any adverse precedent.
Mr. Chairman, if I could...
Representative Smith.
If I could just fill in just a trifle, and then if you want to hear from the TRA, that's fine. The teacher here is employed for the Hopkins Public School District. The teacher did work 80% of full time. She qualified for the allowable service credit. The school failed to timely file its report. I believe the due date in filing was... Well, for the 08-09 school year, the school filed its report almost 9 months after the last deadline for filing at an open hearing where the teacher attempted to reverse the school board's district's denial. At an open hearing, the school district officials acknowledged its reporting error. It was she has no culpability in the failure of the district to file the appropriate and timely filing. That was not done.
Mr. Thompson or Ms. Hacking wish to address this? Welcome. Please identify yourself officially for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Luther Thompson representing TRA. Yeah, I think, you know, the facts have been outlined fairly clearly here. It is in conformity with the principles. There's no adverse equity considerations that should disqualify the teacher. It's based upon the full actuarial value, and Mr. Martin asked about that. The full actuarial value for this is, if assuming the person retires in June of 2012, you know, the month before this bill expires is $8,710. The total contribution and interest for the purchase of this salary credit is $1,446. So the way the bill is written in conformity with these past practices, the member would pay $723.43 if it's paid by August 1st of this year. The school share would be $7,986.80. When the member did appeal to TRA, the appeal was turned down based upon the fact that TRA had no legal authority to waive the statute, which was fairly clear that we had to receive the agreement within 15 months, and as has been stated, it was 9 months late. The school was there. They admitted it was their mistake. And I think this case is a little more straightforward in that the member was in the part-time teacher program in 07 and 08, and everything went according to plan. 08 and 09, she did exactly what she was supposed to do. The school actually approved the part-time teacher program but didn't do anything in any further. The next year, she was in the part-time teacher program, and everything was according to the statute. It wasn't until she came in for to talk to a counselor to see about a retirement benefit that it was noted that the school never sent in the agreement. So TRA is certainly supportive of her position and would not be adversely affected by receiving the full actuarial value.
Mr. Thompson, can you speak to whether or not the school district has rectified the situation that would keep it from happening again?
Well, we've discussed it with the school, and they have, at least in this case, have submitted everything in a timely fashion. It may have been in 2008 and 2009. One of the other issues apparently was they changed over their payroll reporting system from a manual or to some sort of an automatic payment. So that apparently caused them not to notice this. Most of these come in a fairly timely way. We are trying to also go out even 6 months before that date now because of the issue with the layoffs and so forth to try to encourage schools to be more careful about reporting part-time teacher agreements, trying to be a little more proactive and saying, hey, you got to get these in by October 1st. You only have the 15 months, and if you don't, the teacher will be in difficulty.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Luther, or Mr. Thompson. Did the school district gain anything monetarily by their mistake?
Mr. Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, no. In fact, they will lose monetarily by their mistake because instead of simply paying their 5.5% contribution at the time, they have to pay the difference between the members' 5.5% contribution plus interest and the full actuarial value. So they have to pay $7,986. If they'd have done this in a timely fashion, they would have paid $600.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy. Okay. Any other questions from commission members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either Mr. Thompson or Mr. Merton, the last time there was a situation like this was 2000. Am I reading that right?
Mr. Martin?
Members, 2000 is the last I can recall looking through our past records that we did one for the part-time teacher program. We have done other service credit purchases with TRA, but not with this particular program.
I see.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, the two factors that make me...
Representative Kahn, would you use the mic, please? Thank you.
The two factors that make me very amenable to looking favorably on this is the mistake of the school district and the fact that we're doing the full actuarial value. I think when those two things click in, I don't think it becomes controversial at all.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And in reading just through some of these documents, I think there's been a fairly long history that if there's a clerical error, we don't put somebody else in the position of having to pay for that. You know, and so if they were entitled to it to begin with and some of the circumstances that we have here, and I think also, I think the presumption is that the school district would have accuracy in regards to what they would have done. So I think... you would have, Ms. Cooper would have been in a situation of assuming for the most case and then with the electronic documents. So it seems as though the facts are here entitled, and so I think would lend itself that I certainly wouldn't want to see somebody have less than they deserve because of that kind of a clerical error.
Any further questions from commission? Representative Smith, any further comment?
Mr. Chairman and members, no.
Thank you.
Okay, and the number that this bill has, the House file number is, it's Senate file 1252. What is the House number?
Mr. Chairman, the House bill was only dropped in the hopper today, so the only number.
Oh, it'll have a number tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay, we'll get that at that point then.
Very good.
Thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, sir.
And we'll lay this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you.
Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Martin going to do the talking so I don't have to, or do you want me to?
If you would like. Mr. Martin.
Members, this is House File 81. It's tab number 2 in your packets. This has to do with the Public Employees Retirement Association. Specifically has to do with a police officer, so it involves the Public Employees Police and Fire Plan. The individual involved is a 53-year-old full-time police officer in Babbitt. He's been an 18-year full-time police officer with Babbitt, but he also has two periods of employment as a part-time police officer for Buell and for Babbitt. He was eligible for coverage by PERA at that time, but for whatever reason was not reported to PERA. No member contributions were taken, and he doesn't have service credit then for 7 years and 8 months of service credits. With part-time public safety officers, unless the city designates the part-time position as that of a police officer or firefighter, the part-time police officer or firefighter has coverage by the PERA general plan, not the police and fire plan. So this bill provides for the purchase of PERA general plan coverage for this part-time service. The bill provides that the police officer would pay the member contributions that would have been paid if he had been covered, plus 8.5% interest, and that the city of Buell and the city of Babbitt would pay the balance of the full actuarial value of the benefit obtained by the purchase, allocated based on their portions of the benefit amount that would be attributable to each. And it's got a deadline of July 1, 2012, or the date of the individual's retirement to exercise the authority. We raise much of the same questions as before. This is clearly public sector employment. The member is required to pay the member's contribution. The overall purchase requires the full actuarial value payment by some source, because there seems to be an error that the employer is responsible for. The employer is responsible for paying on a mandatory basis some of the cost. There's a question then of violating any notions of equity. The equitable considerations, on the record, it's hard to discern. There doesn't seem to be any, but there is some considerable period of time that has elapsed. The periods of part-time service credit were in July of 88 through November of 96, so we're talking 15 years ago. This would have been easier to take care of if there had been more vigilance on the part of the potential member, and so we may need to take some testimony with respect to whether there was any problem of any equitable consideration about negligence in pursuing the issue earlier. An item that's unique, or an issue that's unique to this one, this particular piece of proposed legislation, is the question of whether the service credit purchase should be in PERA general, which is what this person would have had coverage in if the city did not designate his position as that of a police officer, or whether he should be purchasing service credit in the police and fire plan. I think Ms. Vanek from PERA will have probably something to tell us about that. And then a broad concern that I have that I raise as issue six is the question of enforcing PERA membership coverage requirements. The Pension Commission over the years has seen a fair number of service credit purchase bills, and a fair number of them have been from PERA. Part of the problem is that PERA does exclude individuals who do not earn a minimum salary amount, and the minimum salary amount is $425 per month. So very nominally part-time employees are not covered by PERA. It seems to lead to a circumstance where individuals who start to go over that threshold may or may not be promptly reported to PERA. And if PERA doesn't take fairly significant actions to make sure that individuals in that circumstance get reported, we have circumstances presumably like what gave rise to this bill. The bill seems to be appropriately drafted, so we don't have any technical suggestions for the bill.
Ms. Vanek, Representative Rukavina, did you wish to add to that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think my constituent only actually worked as a full-time officer for a year, if I'm not mistaken. Mr. Martin kind of was quite correct in his presentation. Why I was approached by him at the end of last year, and he asked me about it, and it sounded to me like he probably might qualify, so I had him send his information, and I think he had canceled checks and stubs and everything, and he sent to Ms. Vanek, and she said he clearly qualified. Even though there is a possibility of him being in the police and fire fund, we've chosen to go with the coordinated plan just because, we think that's the way it should be, and the cost, I think, for him to buy back on the police and fire plan would be prohibitive, so I talked to him yesterday about it, and he's fine with that if that's the route that the committee chooses to go on with that. Ms. Vanek can talk about the money end of it.
Okay. Ms. Vanek, welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA Director. As Representative Vanek indicated, Mr. Salo contacted our office in January of 2010, explaining that he had information from his past payroll records that he believed would justify that he should have been reported, and our records showed that he had not been. So upon receipt of his letter, we did contact the cities. They had very thorough records indicating what had transpired over his employment history and agreed that they had misinterpreted our laws and that they understood that he should have been reported. Now, I have not spoken to them since that initial staff inquiry, but I can tell you that in the calculation to grant his service credit in the coordinated plan, which is where part-time police officers are generally reported unless otherwise chosen by the employer, it would cost on an actuarial basis because it also, I need to back up, with adding salary credit to his time, it also increases the police and fire pension that he has earned through his current employment. So between the coordinated plan where he would get granted credit that he doesn't now have, plus the increased salary we would be counting and calculating his police and fire pension, the actuarial cost is a total of $8,302. However, because this is for a period of service years ago, staff has determined that the contributions plus interest actually exceed the actuarial cost. So the law requires that the contributions and interest be paid. His share is approximately $4,408. the city of Babbitt would be required to pay $381 and the city of Buell $4,164 to make his account whole.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could add.
Representative Rukavina.
His pension will be a whopping.
His police and fire pension currently is estimated to be $200 a month. With this credit, he will earn an additional benefit in the coordinated plan of about $30, $31 a month, and his police and fire benefit will increase to roughly $249 a month.
Ms. Vanek, a question again here. Has the city corrected kind of situation to help prevent this from happening again, to your knowledge?
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Martin indicated, our PARA's eligibility rules are much more complex than the other systems. We have several exclusions, and our exclusions have changed over the years. And so we often see employers attempting to do the right thing, but they hire people, they don't realize they exceed the $425 threshold that automatically puts them in, and if they don't catch it fast enough, then they've lost this covered service. We've had exclusions in place. We used to have a rule that says if you earn $5,100 a year, even if you go over $425 one month, as long as your annual earnings are stipulated never to exceed that, the employer doesn't have to report that as long as you were told that in advance. That actually happened to Mr. Salem. So he was legitimately excluded under that rule. But then once they didn't stipulate that again and he went over 425, he had to be reported. We have attempted over the years to streamline our eligibility rules. Haven't been too effective on that. However, we have added a staff person. Now we have two people who are reviewing the exclusion reports that employers are required to submit to us. We are even searching the internet for townships and cities that don't report to us and checking in to see if, in fact, they realize that if they have people that meet our qualifications, they should. Staff told me today that they've identified six small cities that haven't been reported ever to PERA, and they're inquiring about that. And we are engaging in a process to automate this so that employers can send this information to us via the internet through our secured website, and we can do a more thorough job of auditing this in the future, because you do get a lot of these bills from us, and it's really a matter of employers missing that they should have reported people sooner.
Ms. Vanek, have we seen a trend line here that fewer of these kinds of things happening, more of these things that are happening? Any trend that...
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think it has lessened in the last several years based on what we've seen come before you. You used to see, when I first became director 14 years ago, you used to have almost a full legal-length agenda, and most of it was PARA. So we've seen a lessening of it. I will tell you that a bill was introduced recently, however, and I don't know if you're going to hear it, for an issue in Crookston Township where the gentleman should have been reported a long, long time ago. And it's really a matter of the township admitted we can't keep up with all the different rules, and so we have to help make that an easier process.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair, Ms. Vanek, did you say that they acknowledged the error, but you haven't heard from them since? Were you supposed to get some papers from them about it or what?
Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we contacted the Township of Embarrass, the City of Buell, and the City of Babbitt in March of 2010 after we heard from Mr. Salo and asked them to look through their records and provide salary information for us so we could make that determination. And they provided that information for us. We told them that based on our review that he should have qualified earlier than he was reported. But I believe that's the last communication staff had with them. I don't have anything in the record that shows we've had any additional communication.
Mr. Chair, if I could
Representative Rukavina.
Representative Murphy, the gentleman still works part-time for the city of Babbitt, and Babbitt's been paying into the police and fire fund for him. He's just buying back, I believe, the 5 months there. They're well aware of the situation. Buell knows of it. I don't have any official letters of support, but I think I would have heard of opposition if they opposed it.
Further question from commission? Senator Tomasoni, did you wish to add any
He's
comments?
Okay.
Okay. I know
the senator introduced the bill today because, you know, he's been kind of laid up, so I didn't want to put too much pressure on him.
Okay.
And he limped to the table.
Well, we want to give deference to both the Senate and House authors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I'll defer to the people who are on the table.
Okay, okay. Any further question or comment? Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I would just move that this legislation, House File 81, Senate File 1398, be laid over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
Thank you, Member.
Thank you. That's what we will do.
I need to do that for my good friend, Representative Rukavina.
Next, Senator Howe and Representative Kelly. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mr. Chair, we do have a couple of quick amendments for you, author's amendments.
Would you like that, us to take those now before he walks through? Or
I believe that may be easiest, then we'll get the bill in the form that it needs to be.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is
coming.
Moved.
You don't have it.
That's the A1.
They're being distributed now, so we'll wait till they get distributed.
Members, the 1A amendment, just to give you a sense of it, is a technical amendment in doing the 2A amendment that the author requested. I took a more careful look at page 3 of the bill, and there's a semicolon that lands between the Duluth Port Authority, which is in PERA coverage, where other port authorities are not, and the new language, it separates the new language that covers Red Wing, and the functional effect is that it's a disjunctive, not a conjunctive, and it doesn't make the sentence read correctly, and if we don't take care of that semicolon and make sure that Red Wing has the same status as the St. Paul Port Authority, then the bill doesn't quite work. So the 1A amendment is technical. It corrects a drafting error.
Was it Senator Chamberlain or Daley? Senator Daley that moved the 1A? Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Daley has moved the 1A. Any question or discussion about 1A? Representative Kelly, did you what? To add anything to that?
No, Mr. Chair, just a technical amendment there.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Doesn't it need a comma in that sentence somewhere? Seems to be two clauses that need to be separated by a comma or not. No?
Ms. Martin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, right now, after Red Wing, there's a semicolon. Before Red Wing, the clause is other than the St. Paul Port Authority. Then there's a semicolon. And what this is doing is replacing the semicolon with a conjunctive and. So it makes the other work for both St. Paul and Red Wing.
Okay. And
okay, all in favor of the 1A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried. The amendment is adopted. Representative Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And would someone like to move the 2A amendment?
the 2A amendment?
Correct.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll move the 476-2A amendment.
Okay, Representative Kiffmeyer moves the 2A amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, and to the staff, and in deference to Senator Frederickson, is this "were first so employed"? Is that, that sounds kind of awkward. Do you have to have "so employed"? Could you just say "and were first employed"? So or such? You could say "such." He didn't like that either. "And were first such employed." No.
Representative Kelly, any...
such seems awful.
As I was not an English major, Mr. Chair, I'm appreciating the lesson tonight, actually. But I, Advisor of Research, actually did this. I would defer to research.
Members,
Mr. Martin.
If you look at page 4 of the bill, if you flip your packet over in the last page and look at line 4.14, there's a "so employed." What's going on here is whether this is the amendment makes the coverage only for employees who have already been hired by the Red Wing Port Authority and would not be applicable for any future hires for the Port Authority. That's the intent of the author of the bill. And if you make it "so employed," gives you carries with it the idea that you're employed by Red Wing. And it keys everything on "first employed by Red Wing." Getting rid of the "so" leaves you "first employed," presumably by any PERA public employer.
So it changes the meaning.
And I think it changes the meaning. And although it's not the optimal language, you are definitely correct. It parrots what's already in the bill and does carry a meaning that can be understood. So.
I appreciate the eagle eye when it comes to looking at this language, so thank you, Senator Pappas.
The eagle eye.
Eagle.
I thought you were kidding.
Any further discussion on the 2A amendment? If not, all in favor of the 2A amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. The 2A amendment is adopted. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, and that's exactly right. I certainly appreciate the explanation there, what our intent is. We have members of the Port Authority, and I'll let an individual from Red Wing here speak to it, that have been in the program. They've been contributing. The city's been contributing. They're just not statutorily so, which we have to add this language. But what we'd like to do is to cover those people that have been in it. But what the amendment did was to say going forward that those new hires would not be. So I will defer, Mr. Chair, to Roger Seymour of the City of Red Wing.
Representative Murphy, before he testifies?
Yes.
Yes,
Representative
Murphy.
Representative Kelly, why not? Why can't future employees qualify?
Representative Kelly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, this was an issue that was discussed on going forward. If the individuals are going to be part of a plan, they could also be hired by the city. I will again ask to defer to Mr. Seymour for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Seymour, please identify yourself for the record, and you may proceed.
Yes, Roger Seymour, Employee Services Director with the City of Red Wing. Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I'd like to thank and appreciate your support in speaking with you regarding this legislation tonight. I also want to thank Senator Howe and Representative Kelly and also Chairman Lanning for co-authoring this. Since 1984, 1985, we have been taking out portions deducting a portion of them for the Port Authority, for the retirement for them. We were notified last summer that we shouldn't be doing that after an inquiry from another city, and we've been trying to rectify the situation with that. This goes back before my time and several others, so we really don't know how this came about, but it is, and it is what it is right now. But in answer to Representative Murphy, our initial intent was that we did include all future employees also. But we'd sort of like that. But right now, our main focus is to take care of the retirees that are under para right now and the current employees we do have. We have three now. We did lay off one last fall. We do have three current ones that we want to make sure that they have their pension.
Yeah. Senator Howe, did you wish to add anything?
I think Representative Kelly and Roger Seymour summed it up. It's just it was an oversight on multiple levels. You know, we actually have retirees that have paid in, and the pension board said we needed to get this resolved this year, so we're hoping that that we can come to a resolution and get it done.
Mr. Martin, did you wish to comment on this?
Members, I think the primary question here is why were port authorities excluded back in 1959? Was there a good pension reason to do it? And is that, if there was a good pension reason to do it, is there still that same reason applicable now? We've done some looking at this, and it seems to us that the exclusion of port authorities, which still occurs with the exception of the St. Paul Port Authority, was done more because of the lateness of PERA and coordinating with Social Security and the desire to have the Port Authority employees covered by Social Security, and PERA was not set up to accommodate that. PERA did not coordinate with Social Security until 1964 or 65. And that seems to be the only reason. So hence, I don't think that there's a reason particular that Port Authorities are inappropriately covered by PERA. It's a matter more of historical circumstance. The Port Authority of St. Paul back, I think, in 2000 or 2001 sought to be included in PERA coverage. The question here is this Port Authority has always been a member of PERA incorrectly. PERA accepted the membership reporting and the contributions and only recently concluded that the Port Authority should not be covered. The alternative resolution, if this piece of legislation doesn't pass, is that there is general provisions in PERA law that everybody essentially gets a refund of past contributions, and that may not be the optimal resolution for long service public employees who thought they had PERA coverage for a long period of time. The other issue, the last issue that I raise, is the question of if you're going to cover port authorities. This had more application when this was a both retroactive and prospective bill. What about the other port authorities in the state of Minnesota? The best that I can find out is there are 25 port authorities. It's not clear how many of those actually do have employees. And if you were to generally change the law, or if you were to change the law and make this particular port authority comparable to any other PERA-covered employer, what about the other port authorities? Now that you've made this bill only applicable retroactively for employees who've been hired up to this point and not for prospectively hired employees, that question is still would be less clear whether the question is appropriate or should be answered in a way that would make all port authorities PERA-covered employers. Ms. Vanek may have some comments also.
Yeah. Mr. Martin, and I guess I'd have the same question of Ms. Vanek. Over these years, statutes governing port authorities have changed significantly, and wondering if there's been any recent review of how those statutes might have impacted the history here in terms of how port authorities were regarded. Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Vanek, para. We have attempted to administer the law as it was written. Why the port authorities were excluded, I didn't understand until Mr. Martin had written his memo with respect to St. Paul when they asked to be included as an employer. There's nothing to indicate that a port authority is any less a local government governmental entity than the other entities we cover, but at one point they asked to be excluded. It's not any different than city managers in the 70s asked to be excluded from membership in PERA. They asked to actually opt in, and they asked to not be in at all unless they asked to be in, so that was an individual choice. And then that was reversed within the last decade because they decided the group of city managers decided they wanted the coverage. The history of if you look at PERA's definition of governmental subdivision, there are a number of them that are written in as governmental entities covered by us because at one point they were not covered by us for some reason, and it usually was by their choice. The City of Red Wing's Port Authority is similar to the Red Wing Environmental Learning Center. In 2003, they discontinued their relationship with the school district. The school district was their fiscal agent. You remember this, Representative Murphy? And they came forward to us and said, spin us off and put us on our own separate report. And we said, well, who are you? They then reported to us as school district employees, and when we researched it, we questioned whether or not they should have been in PERA. And legislation was enacted to affirmatively list them as a covered employer, and now they're reporting separately. So this is similar. The City of Red Wing acted as the fiscal agent for the Port Authority, and the contributions were reported to us with all other city employees. And there are a couple of membership forms that I reviewed that did indicate they were Port Authority employees, but were very automated. And information comes in, and it is electronically updated to the system that these are our members, and a contribution comes in, and it's a legitimate contribution with a salary that meets our definition. And so, okay, they're reported by the City of Red Wing employees, they're members. And that's how this all unfolded, and it wasn't until I received a phone call from another city who was inquiring why the City of Red Wing Port Authorities were in our plan. And I looked in our system, and they weren't listed as a separate employer, so I asked the staff to research it. We worked with Mr. Seymour, and we uncovered that, yes, in fact, they'd been reporting them for years. And I said, well, under the statute, if you are structured under these sections of law, you don't qualify as an employer, and your employees shouldn't be reported to us, so we need to go to the legislature and talk about that. With respect to the other port authorities, we don't reach out and ask the question. We certainly can, but we haven't initiated that. As you can tell by the previous bill, we have plenty to do with just monitoring those who are already reporting to us. Does that answer your question, Mr.
Yes, thank you. In fact, I see Mr. Carlson is here from the League of Cities. Maybe they take a look at this down the road. It strikes to me that we ought to take a closer look at that, not here tonight, but taking a look at this statewide to see if we need to make some adjustments. Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, and I was just going to comment. I'm not sure if Representative Murphy asked this question or someone else, but the reason that, certainly I think initially we thought we'd just include the Port Authority, the Red Wing Port Authority, but we thought that there's been employees that have paid in for decades, and there's, this mistake isn't just of something that's recent. So it would take significant funds that would have to be sent back, and then the City of Red Wing would have to restructure their own pension fund. But with respect to the other port authorities, we didn't want desperate treatment there either. So I think if we take care of the employees that are currently being counted now and include them, and with this amendment, you're not taking on any new members, but yet you could still have that conversation of whether or not all port authorities should be taken in or not.
Yeah, thank you, Senator. Other questions from the commission? Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think an excellent discussion and very sympathetic whenever you're, just like the other time, you have somebody who acted on good faith. Certainly want to make sure they're not, and I think then the financial cost to us, but I think we do need to have that larger overall. It's just not fair, it seems to me, that others who just happen not to be here don't have that. And so I think we ought to do that. We ought to do it so that it affects everybody and have a clear policy decision. But the one thing that does kind of puzzle me is that you're testifying here that they could just, that these new or these other employees of the Red Wing Port Authority could just become city employees. If that's the case, why not just do that? I'm just a little bit puzzled as to why that would be a problem.
Who would like to respond?
Or maybe it's not a problem.
Representative Kelly or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, I will defer to Mr. Seymour. I may have misspoke, so I'll let Mr. Seymour answer. Okay.
Mr. Seymour.
Yes, Chairman, members of the Commission, Representative Kiffmeyer. That's a good question. And I think in regards to other port authorities, we've had discussions with my port director and other people, and there has been some membership issues, or maybe they're not Port Authority employees, maybe they're somewhere else, but I think there is some people covered that work in Port Authorities, but maybe the employer is the city, but other things like that. So I'm not sure globally how much this affects other cities in that regard. But
well, Mr. Chairman, I think it just indicates the need for a larger global kind of discussion about this that obviously maybe even has a couple issues embedded in here, and that's not unusual that this, and I think it is better for us to take care of these current employees, and in this kind of situation I think is good for the fund as well as good for them, but I do think the rest of it will be better served by taking that time and asking staff and helping us and to take a look at that, I think.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, also
Mr. Seymour.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, well, that's one of the discussions I know recently we had with our port authority, I believe Monday night, was if this legislation does not pass, you know, how do we go, how do we move forward with our current employees and future employees? What do? Do we, you know, make them city employees somehow that they would be included into PARA?
Any further question or discussion? Representative Kiffmeyer, do you want to move that we lay this over?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we could lay it over, and that is, being new to the pension, that is the customary thing. Are there any bills that are ever, I'm just curious, moved on to the floor, or is this?
Well, there could be, Representative Kiffmeyer. We're talking about these are individual situations that I think is best put together in an omnibus bill, and okay. I see Representative Murphy shaking her head yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
They're safer that way.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, then I would move that these be laid. This 476 House file and Senate file 176 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
And
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator, Representative Kelly.
Thank you. Just as a process would be that for inclusion in a bill that will be passed this year, or
yes, okay. Representative Kelly, we're
okay.
You may not have
just wanted to clarify.
You may not have heard what I said at the outset, but we're tentatively looking at possibly acting on the omnibus bill on Monday the 16th, if that date works out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we want to get that done before session is over, and this also has to go to respective House and Senate committees, too. So so we'll need to be done with it. Yep.
Plenty of time.
Thank you, Mr.
Plenty of time. All the time in the world, right?
No.
Not quite. All right. The next bill is House File 1338, Senate File 1113. Representative McFarland and Senator Chamberlain.
Good
Welcome to the committee, Representative McFarland. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1338, Senate File 130. Does Mr. Martin have anything to say on this first, like you did on the others, or you want me to?
Well, you can. You can. You can make some comments and then ask him to.
Okay.
Yeah. Comment I'll just, as. I'll just. You can talk as much as you think you want to.
Anyway.
Within reason.
Okay. The City of White Bear Lake and the White Bear Lake Volunteer Fire Department Relief Association came to me asking to help them with a technical amendment to authorize the use of special actuarial work in determining the 2009 and 10 special fund financial requirement minimum municipal obligations. After reviewing their options, we met with Mr. Martin. And then I think that after you hear the testimony today, you will find that the city has proven that their pension is fully funded at 113.4%, and the additional city pension contribution of $70,000 calculated by the OSA, according to the current statute, would not be appropriate calculation for this one instance, given the data, the updated actuarial valuations for the city of White Bear Lake. And if I could, I'd like to have my testifier speak to this.
Yes. Mr. Rambo and, yes, please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don Rambo, Finance Director for the City of White Bear Lake. The city has followed state statute by doing an actuarial study every 2 years, and one of the requirements was that it was completed right at the time when all the other, as the memo says, the Great Recession hit and our funds were devalued or lost value, and we came out at 87% funded. Now, the city is fully aware of the responsibility that it has to adequately fund the pension fund. And as the 2009 came about, we noticed and watched as the stock market returned its value, and we watched our pension fund grow. And in fact, excuse me, I'm sorry. In fact, by October of 2009, the fund had recovered itself to being 100% or 101% funded. We did what was called an interim valuation at that time. Gabriel Roder Smith, our actuarial, did a study and came back and confirmed that our pension fund was in fact 100% or 101% funded. But the problem becomes it happened in October, and we were required by state statute to submit a report I believe by September 1st. So the timing was skewed. And I talked with the state auditor's office and said there's really no option here for them to look at a different date than what they had. So we continued to look at this. We talked about our options. And really, with Larry Martin's help, the only other alternative is to ask for special legislation. Again, I want to stress that we're fully aware of the city's responsibility to make sure the fund is fully funded. And in fact, if it wasn't, we would not be here. But the other side of this is statute also talks about GASB 25, and they're saying that actuarial should be done when there are significant changes to the fund. An example would be if there's a fund increase. In fact, in 2007, the city did increase their pensions for the Relief Association because we were at 121% funded, and we felt that that was adequate enough to give the Relief Association and the membership more funding. And we took it down to 114%. I had no idea that the recession was going to hit and hit as hard as it did and take us down to 87%. But as GASB 25 says, we should do actuarial studies when there's significant valuation changes. We did, but the timing did not coincide with the state statute, so that's why we're here this evening.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Sather. I'm the city manager in Wape Air, and I just want to follow up a little bit on what Don's comments were, Mr. Ramble's comments. If we follow the language in the current statute, it took our actuarial report that was due at that time took a snapshot of the fund condition, and it was at a very significant low point. We worked hard, worked on investments, and got it back up. And now, as our last two reports have shown that, as Mr. Ramble mentioned, a little bit over 100% and now over 110%. And if it's akin, I think, to the legislature as you deal with your budget problems or our state's budget problems. If you looked at the November revenue report, it showed the condition of the state much worse than your February report. And this would be akin to asking the legislature to use the data from an old report as you deal with current times. So we now have an actuarial study that meets all the conditions of law, all the conditions of GADSBY. It's a solid study, and it shows that we're fully funded and that to require the city to levy $70,000 would be excessive. So we're asking for this, for your consideration on this bill, and we think that it is sound and it does not put our fund at risk.
Mr. Martin, want to add comments to that?
Members, at some point I think we do need to get the state auditor's office involved. The first policy issue that I raise is whether the proposed piece of legislation meets all the requirements that the state auditor's office is likely to be pursuing. If we're going to do a special remedy, the first question, I think, is make sure that this is the full remedy. And the state auditor's office will need to tell us whether this fully returns White Bear Lake to the straight and narrow path. I do raise some questions about interim valuation results. Issue 2 and Issue 4 precedent are somewhat interconnected. This is not... using interim valuation results has not occurred in the past in effect some version of an interim valuation is used when there is a benefit increase that's being considered but that's a valuation as of the date of the last valuation basically shows you what the impact of the benefit change might be if it were applicable to the date of the last valuation. It doesn't attempt to project liabilities as the interim valuation did here. So there is a question about setting the precedent of using interim valuations that are not done completely according to either statute or the standards for actuarial work. I do set out on pages 2 and 3, the comparison of the various valuations, both before the interim valuation work and the most recent valuation, and the plan is more typically fully funded than it turned out in the 2009 valuation. So the health of this plan is good, and the most recent valuation does indicate that the trend line shown in the interim actuarial work is correct, so there's some reason to be receptive to the solution presented. But as I indicated in item 4, there's no past precedent that I can identify for validating interim valuations, and there is some potential in the passage of this that a similar circumstance could arise at a similar remedy as this be sought. Saying that there are only 23 volunteer fire plans out of the almost 800 volunteer fire plans in the state of Minnesota that provide in whole or in part monthly benefits, so that the pool of possible instances that this could occur in the future is relatively small with only 23 municipalities involved. But these monthly benefit plans are, in effect, mini insurance companies. They do need some actuarial work to ensure that the our reserves are properly calculated and that there are that there is sufficient funding. It's a fairly complicated way to provide volunteer fire pension benefits, and that's essentially item five, which is a one of the more global issues. Is with so few monthly benefit volunteer fire plans and with the somewhat extensive work that's needed compared to a lump sum volunteer fire plan with a monthly benefit plan, should they be encouraged or should the commission or the legislature take steps to try and convince the remaining monthly benefit plans to convert to simpler plans and utilize the purchase of insurance company annuities rather than self-insuring for monthly benefits. But I think at this point it probably would be appropriate to have the State Auditor's Office make their comments.
Auditor Otto, would you come forward, please? We'll give the our testifiers an opportunity to respond to what's been said here. And welcome, Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commission members. So we're neutral on this bill, and White Bear got their local government aid for 2010. They'll be eligible for their 2011 aid if they submit their forms by this June. So if you were to make this fix for them, then they would be, I think the question was, would they be in good standing, Mr. Martin asked, and they could be. This is simply something we could not do for them. And so, unless there's any other questions?
Questions from the commission. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, does this come in conflict with any of the principles?
Mr. Martin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, there are no specific principles that have to do with actuarial reporting that I can recall.
And so, Mr.
Chair, Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, so it's a reporting thing more than
Representative, yes.
The fact that they're trying to use some other actuarial reporting or actuarial
standard.
Members, the actuarial work that we require of volunteer fire plans, the 23 monthly plans, has a date specific set forth in statute. The valuations are always supposed to be prepared as of December 31st, January 1, December 31st for the financial and demographic work and prospective. So it's the liabilities as of July 1. And one of the problems here is this was done at an odd date. It was not a December 31st, January 1st date. It was not a full valuation. It has a few deficiencies in it, which are noted in the memo. And we generally don't allow volunteer fire plans to pick and choose the valuation timing or composition. We require city funding if the actuarial work shows that city funding is needed, and having a set standard applied evenly and recurringly makes sense. And for reasons that White Bear Lake has tried to explain, that didn't work for them, but that is the general rule.
Thank you.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate the State Auditor Otto being here today. Though the one thing that I have a question of here in your testimony is one thing, but also in our report here, the sufficiency of the proposed legislation. is what you are saying then, that if this legislation were to pass, this is all that is needed, there is nothing else needed?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, as far as our office is concerned, yes, they would be back in good standing. And, you know, Mr. Martin brings up the precedent issue. You know, if a lot of them did it, it would be an issue. But I think this is a hopefully an isolated situation.
Mr. Chairman, I think.
Kiffmeyer.
Thank you. Under on our page 2 and that so on, it was several other things as well. And I was curious. There's a listing here of about 6 different items. Are those addressed as well through the auditor, state auditor's office, or dealt with in any way, shape, or form?
Auditor Otto.
Mr. Chair, this is Mr. Martin's memo, and so I have not read the whole memo. You might want to direct your questions to Mr. Martin. If I can provide clarification after that, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman. I realize that. So,
Mr. Martin.
Members, the yes. on page 2, I've tried to lay out the areas that the interim work where it was deficient, that it didn't use the right reporting date, it did not use new membership information. It didn't newly calculate the various actuarial items fresh, but it simply adapted the prior actuarial accrued liability figure by taking a proportional share of the normal cost and adding it in. It used unaudited asset values, best that I could tell, on a date other than the annual financial reporting date, and it didn't disclose the assumptions or the benefit provisions. So it was, there's a logic to what the actuary did, but it is not the way that the actuary report should be newly generated and complete. Now, it was substantiated by the subsequent regular actuarial evaluation done on the right date and done essentially in the right way, and that's laid out on the bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3. So if it were the interim actuarial work only, and there was and it was not substantiated by additional actuarial work, it was done in the right way, I think there would be more concern on the part of the commission logically. Having it substantiated by regularly prepared actuarial work means that while it's a messy process, we're not putting this pension plan in any jeopardy, that they're going to stay on funding track, that things are okay, even though it's a little messy getting there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that was very helpful, Mr. Martin. I really appreciate your insights in that regard. I think I just wanted to call attention to and maybe to the authors or to the presenter here, testify here today, that the concept, sympathetic to the fact that running these things can take a fair amount of knowledge or effort, and yet it seems this is a one incident maybe, so we don't want to hyper-react to it. On the other hand, it talks about these 23 volunteer firefighter relief associations, and another way of handling this that might help you in the future. Now, that is your decision. That is not necessarily a matter for us, but I would be interested in hearing your thoughts in regards to this one was to do something like an alternative that they convert to an insurance company purchased annuity. I was just interested in, since you're here, and if you had any comment in regards to Mr. Martin's putting this here. And I'm always well aware of a lot of work you have in front of you, and that anything that can make life a little simpler and avoid some of these technicalities, I just wanted to be sure and maybe get any input you might have while you're here.
Is that to Mr. Rambo or Mr. Sather?
Well, to whoever feels they would feel able to reply to that, I will defer to their choice of who.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, I agree with Mr. Martin's suggestion there, and we can certainly take that into consideration. But I think it's important. What we'd like to present is, for over 100 years, this has not been a problem with this fund, and the fund has been sound. Both the Relief Association as well as the Mayor and City Council have been very cautious in granting increases in benefits, and generally speaking, for many years, the city has not had to contribute any additional local taxpayer funds into the fund. The revenue earnings as well as the state aid was sufficient to cover the benefit levels. And in fact, the report was first brought up as an issue when we met with Mr. Martin, he raised those concerns or those deficiencies. And we didn't necessarily disagree with him, but we had been looking at it differently. Again, that we had not changed. One more point where we agree with Mr. Martin is it is like a small insurance company. And the real difficult aspect of it is calculating the requirements of the fund. So that's where the real actuarial science comes in. And yet that, in our opinion, really wasn't at question here. What happened is the value of the assets to support that fund had dropped from sufficient to insufficient. And it quickly recovered in a relatively short period of time. So really what we wanted to show was that the assets had recovered to a point that it was sufficiently funded. We didn't feel it was necessary to spend extra money to go back and reaffirm the requirements of the fund because the benefits hadn't changed. There were no significant changes in the membership, either new members or retirees, beyond what had been the usual and customary over the last several decades. But when that point was brought up, we felt that we wanted to show our sincerity and to just double check. So we went back and did a full study that we think is totally compliant. And that reaffirmed that by that time, because more months had gone by, that the fund was even more sound. So we felt that it even more so at that point, it just didn't seem reasonable to levy additional taxes on our residents to fund a fund that was overly funded already. And but if this were to come again, or we can continue to monitor it, many cities have started to phase out. In fact, we have done that, where we've gone to the lump sum option for our officers. So for a long time, it was simply a defined benefit plan, so to speak, and with a monthly annuity. And we now offer a lump sum. And as we're finding, some of the new members of the Relief Association are finding that that's fine. So it could be that we're in the process of phasing out with the support of all the firefighters that are involved.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Those were excellent comments to make and very informative. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair.
Auditor Otto.
I just have a slightly further clarification for Representative Kiffmeyer. Of the 23 that are left, almost all of them have done away with the monthly option for their new members, so it is changing. So
that was going to be a question I was going to ask you. So is your experience that things are improving with regard to the monthly plans?
Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Senator Pogemiller, did you?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just briefly. So kind of bottom line, for whatever reason, good reason or not, the law was not followed in terms of White Bear Lake's auditing or actuarial work. When's the next actuarial? When is the subsequent validation by a complete actuary going to take place?
Mr. Seymour? I'm sorry. Mr. Rambo.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have complied and have done the actuarial studies with this in compliance with the state auditor's office. We just completed a full one January 1st, 2011, which shows that we are 113% funded. We actually did a secondary audit on October or for October 2009 because we knew that the fund, we were watching the fund and watching the fund grow and figured that the fund was more than 100% funded. And that's why we chose to look at the funding contributions, because at that time we felt that the fund, the October 2009 results said we did not need to levy taxes. We did not need to fund it to the level that the January 2009 actuarial stated. Mr. Chair, just so we know, the Fire Relief Association is in support of this bill. In fact, when we were at the Senate committee, our president of the Relief Association was with us to testify for this bill. Tonight, he was unable to come due to prior commitments.
Senator Pogueller.
Mr. Chairman, so I think what you just said is the subsequent validation by a complete actuarial evaluation has taken place.
Has taken place, and it is on file. And the commission has it. Larry Martin has it. It's just waiting to go to the auditor's office.
Further question from the commission?
Is that correct?
Yes. And the next evaluation would be due in 2013, would be as of January 2013. But there has been a validation after the interim valuation, which discloses or indicates the same trend line.
Which justifies that yes. White Bear, and they don't need a municipal contribution. So what's the problem? Let's just do it.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, and I was going to ask Mr. Sather then, the $70,000 is what you would be required to pay because of the 2009...
Mr. Sather?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct. And that's the one that we think the subsequent reports shows is unnecessary.
The 2011 report says that you have enough money. And so you're saying that you would prefer us to accept the 2011 actuarial report.
Yeah. Mr. Sather?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelly, that's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah. Further questions from the commission?
It's an amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, we have an amendment that is that has that been passed out?
Members, it's in your packet. It's right in front of the bill. It's a Senate
page
Council
11.
Amendment, page 11. There was some bobbling of the name of the Other Relief Association, and this clarifies it.
Would someone wish to move that amendment? Pardon me?
Move the amendment.
Representative Kahn, move the amendment. A discussion on the amendment? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried.
Mr.
The amendment is adopted. Representative McFarland, did you?
Did Senator Daley have a question?
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. Mr. Seymour, you had mentioned that you'd worked on investments and got it back up. What do you mean by that specifically? And what I'm wondering is who manages the investments? Is it the state board or is it a different entity?
Mr. Sather?
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, the funds are actually managed, or they're under the auspices of our Relief Association, and our finance director, Mr. Ramble, sits in on that and works with them on the investment, and they do consult with a professional investment firm on making those decisions, but they are handled locally. And we do compare, I don't want to editorialize, but we do compare with the state Board of Investment, and I believe that we have actually exceeded that over the last 2 years.
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chair, what kinds of things do you invest in?
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Senator
Randall.
Daley, the White Bear Lake Fire Relief Association has authorized Wells Fargo to invest in, as the state board, and they invest in growth stocks, the mutuals, and conservative cash investments. But there have been international stocks that they've invested in. At one time, and again, I don't want to take the committee's time, At one time, there was significant discussion on the board whether we should stay with the private investment firm or move to the State Board of Investments. And the Board of Trustees of the Relief Association, the vote was to stay with the local board and not move to the State Board of Investments. And I think that movement has kept the private investors very cognizant of what they're doing and very kind of watch out as to how their investments are done so that there's not another movement to go back to the State Board of Investments.
Just one final question, Mr. Chair. I believe Mr. Martin made the comment about making sure that the remedy, the special remedy, make sure it's full. In your view, was that you, Mr. Martin? In your view, are we doing that with this?
Mr. Martin?
Members, what I was referring to is the state auditor is the judge of whether all of the requirements have been met. They determine whether or not White Bear Lake receives fire state aid in subsequent years. So I was framing the question as one that should be answered by the Office of the State Auditor. Does this resolve the issue that they have? Does this resolve the item that would disqualify White Bear Lake from fire state aid? And the response from Auditor Otto was that it did.
Mr. Chair, members, I do have concerns about what Mr. Martin has put in Section 2 and Section 4. This would be the first time. This would set a precedent, and I'm not sure that we necessarily want to go down that path without having a good discussion about that, or at least a brief discussion about setting a precedent. This would be the first time that we do something of this nature, and the October 19, 2009 interim actuarial work is substandard, as was mentioned in number 2. And in the legislation, we're saying let's refer to that and let's use that interim valuation as of October 19, 2009, even though it was substandard, as mentioned in his note. So I just want to express that my concern, being new to the commission or to this pension commission, I'm not sure how significant or important that is, but it seems if he took the time to write that note, that it is a concern.
Senator Pappas.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I didn't find this until kind of reading it more carefully, but on page 1, just to repeat, it does say that their substandard report was subsequently validated by a complete actuarial valuation prepared at the plan year start, which they mentioned. So it's kind of like you shouldn't have done it, don't do it again, but we'll let you get away with it this time. That's how I feel. You know, I'd hate to have them after. They don't need to put the $70,000 in the fund. And everybody's, you know, money's tight for everyone. And I just don't think we need to punish them for, you know, having made a mistake.
Any further discussion?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a motion we lay this over for possible inclusion. But I do have a question as to process and if that motion is made for possible inclusion, you know, how do we address the issue of the precedent or anything else that, and again, this may be a product of the fact that we're some new members on the commission. So, but I think it is valid in that situation to, yet on the other hand, if we make this motion to do that and it proceeds, is there another process by which we as members of the commission can either get additional information or consideration or discussion, or is this kind of it?
Representative Kiffmeyer, I think one of the study things that we need to take a closer look at is the monthly plan, those 23. And I was pleased to hear that the auditor feels that things have improved there and that there's less of this kind of thing that's happening. But since the question has been raised, since it's happened, it certainly would be, I think, advisable for us to take a closer look. And by laying it over here tonight, we can still, if new information or new concerns come to the fore, before we actually act on the omnibus bill, we can address that at at that time. Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, I was going to mention, too, for Representative Kiffmeyer, that we issue an annual report on these volunteer fire reliefs. And so we've got lots of numbers and lots of data and their investment returns and all of that, how many members, everything. So we'll make sure that you get a copy of that. And there's a fairly recent one out, so we can get that, too, if you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Auditor Otto. I do appreciate that. But I think there were a lot of good things that were said here, too, and some of the good directions, some of those other things that I think helped to ameliorate or alleviate some of that, some of those concerns. And I think the one issue somewhat is precedent. But, Mr. Chairman, with that understanding that as we review this further, that we may have an opportunity. And sometimes, as you know, it sits a while and you read these things and your mind goes through it and it can set well. But with that, Mr. Chairman, that's my motion to lay it over for possible inclusion.
Okay. We will lay this over. And thank you very much for being here this evening.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And we will now move to House File 1415 and Senate File 1129, Representative Moline and Senator Tomasoni. Welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. Commission members.
Mr. Chairman, how do you want us to proceed?
Well, if you want to make some comments or you just want Mr. Martin to present it, and then
I can make a quick comment, and I think Representative Moline can make another quick comment, and then I guess.
Okay, go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, this Senate File 1129 and House File 1415 is quite frankly, it's a bill that would extend a deadline that is an extension of a deadline already. And essentially speaking, the November 30th deadline that is in statute, my understanding, is a deadline that is an extension of another deadline for filing of Relief Association annual financial reports. And in the case of Hibbing, the city of Hibbing filed a report, but the Volunteer Relief Association that needed to file a report didn't get the report in on time. And so Hibbing's requesting an extension of that deadline to be allowed to recoup the money. The money is about $57,000, it looks like. And I think there's some pretty good demonstration of the Relief Association's inability to conform with the extent with the deadline that the November 30th deadline, and so what we're doing is requesting that an exception be allowed here for the city of Hibbing to extend this deadline to April 30th and be allowed to collect the money. And Representative Moline, I think, can give you a few more specifics.
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, along those same lines, again, we're just asking for an extension in the filing deadline. All the paperwork is currently submitted, which is why our bill changes the deadline to April 30th, 2011, which we know has already passed because all the documents were filed by that date. We wrote the language so that it would only apply to the city of Hibbing. And the situation that we're in is that the city of Hibbing has both full-time firefighters and volunteer firefighters. And I think they're one of the few, if not the only, city where both the full-time firefighters and the volunteer firefighters must file these papers and then rely on each other to get them in. The city of Hibbing did timely file all of the required information, but the Volunteer Relief Association did not. And because of that, the City of Hibbing and the Volunteer Relief Association, they're treated as one entity and neither then received its 2010 state fire aid. They subsequently found out, and the state auditor did give them probably several notices to both the city and the Volunteer Fire Association. But eventually the city discovered that the president of the Volunteer Relief Association had sustained a disabling injury to his back at work and was unable to work and was receiving constant medical treatments in 2010. So all the notices that were going to the volunteer firefighters were going to the president, who was disabled and receiving medical treatments. And so because of that, the volunteers didn't get their paperwork in time, and therefore the city and the volunteers did not receive their state fire aid. And as I stated, all the paperwork is in now, so we would just ask for an extension of the deadline.
Representative Moline, do you know if the city has put in additional safeguards so that kind of thing doesn't happen again?
Well, you know, I can't comment, I guess, to any specific safeguards that they've put in. The city of Hibbing, they did actually terminate their city administrator about 2 weeks ago because it was the opinion of the city council that he was not fulfilling a lot of his duties as city administrator. I don't know specifically had he been fulfilling his duties that this wouldn't have happened, but he was terminated 2 weeks ago. So.
And Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
probably should also state that the president of the Relief Association did eventually resign, and because of his back problems and because of his inability to fulfill his duties. And then the new president apparently wasn't communicating with the old president in regards to the forms that were necessary to be filed, and I think that's where the disconnect came here. So,
Mr. Martin?
Members, the memo in this is relatively short. It raises three issues. Does talk about the number of volunteer fire entities that are presumably affected by the proposed bill. The authors indicate that Hibbing is their primary concern, but there are two other municipalities, one in Maurer County and one other one in St. Louis County that also forfeited aid in 2010 that presumably are also covered by the legislation. So that's our assessment of who the bill applies to. We do raise in policy issue two that there are a fair number of late report filers. The volunteer fire community over time has in the neighborhood of a quarter or thereabouts, quarter to a third of the volunteer fire plans file late to some degree, get some of their fire state aid withheld for a period of time or withheld ultimately. So there is a pattern here. This may not be the only instance where there are forfeitures. And as a consequence, the precedent, we can't identify any past time where we've extended the particular deadline date for the fire state aid program. There undoubtedly have been deadline extensions that have been approved in the pension area, but none that we can identify for the fire state aid program. And given the number of municipalities that do in some sense, chronically report late, there is always some considerable danger that this could become a precedent for the future.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Martin. If the aid is withheld, it says withheld. So does that mean that when they do finally file the report, then the aid is released, or do they lose the aid permanently?
Mr. Martin.
Senator Pappas, both. If they miss the initial filing deadline, their aid is not paid in October as it normally would be. It's withheld for a period of time. When they do catch up, they would be paid. If they miss the several deadlines, then it ultimately will be forfeited.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, on this extensive list on page 2 and 3, how many of these were forfeited?
Mr. Martin?
I would like to be able to tell you, but the reporting that I get, I get a run from the Revenue Department, and sometimes they give us more information, sometimes they give us less. This is essentially all the information I have. I don't get a lot of information on forfeitures.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Martin, then is this the first?
The State Auditor's Office is the entity that certifies who have complied and who have not complied, and they can give us a better sense.
My question is this the first time that anyone had allegedly forfeited money that they then asked to have it not forfeited? Is this the first time that that's happened? Did anyone ever ask and have it refused, or what?
We've had one other instance where fire state aid was not paid to a municipality, and they did seek a legislative remedy. In that case, it was an expenditure item that was in question that caused the non-payment or the forfeiture of, or potential forfeiture of the fire state aid. Was the city of Austin, and it was in 1977. So it was not an analogous. It was the same result, as it were, but not the same cause. It was not a failure to file reports. It was that they reported that they expended money essentially on legislative lobbying, and that was viewed, that was thrown out, that was challenged by the insurance commissioner at that time, which was the entity that ran the fire state aid program.
But otherwise...
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, so none of these... We don't know that any... That's the only case with essentially legal activity instead of just a late one.
Well, I would point you, Representative Kahn, to page one. Maple View did forfeit its aid both in 2010 and in 2009. That's the Maurer County municipality. And in 2009, I can identify two other, Keister in Faribault County and Twin Lakes in Manoman County, that also forfeited fire state aid in 2009.
But, Mr. Chairman, they never asked for any legislative remedy.
No.
Because it's a little... The legislative failed to tell them they should do this.
The state auditor also can give us some sense about the relative magnitude of forfeitures better than I can.
Auditor Otto, would you weigh in on this, please?
Mr. Chair, for your convenience, I brought the numbers because I thought there might be questions. So there's quite a few that are late, but they have to report by October 1st. And if they don't do that, then they're going to forfeit their aid. They have several opportunities to take care of compliance issues. So there's four rounds. There's four rounds in terms of being able to get their aid. So if there's compliance issues, if they miss the first round, they can try to get in the second round anyway. The last round is on June 15th. Starting in 93, there were seven entities that didn't get their fire state aid. And then for several years, there were zero that none of them forfeited. The next year that there was forfeitures was 2003. There were three of them. In 2004, there were four. In five, there was one. Six, there was zero. Seven, there was zero. Eight, there was three. And nine, there was three. And Maple View was one that was not in compliance. They're working on resolving their situation. And, so that's it. I hope that's helpful. But there's quite a few that don't get the report, that have issues they have to resolve before they can get certified. So.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. State Auditor Otto, do they have to give a reason for their forfeiture on the state aid? Is there a reason, or they just don't reply back to you?
Auditor Otto.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if the forms are late, if they don't get their forms in, they have to do certain reporting requirements in order to get their money, so they have to get their forms in, yeah. And it can be a variety of issues. I can tell you that my staff works really, really hard to try to help these folks be successful in their reporting. There's regular communication, and it's a very, very special group of people. They work to save our lives. You know, they're willing to run into burning buildings, and this isn't necessarily their forte. And so my staff really bends over backwards to try to help these folks be successful. And sometimes there are situations, but they certainly, they don't drive to places, but they certainly do everything they can to help them be successful.
So. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Tomasoni, how big is Hibbing?
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, Hibbing's about 17,000.
17,000. And Mr. Chair.
And Senator Rosen, just to be clear, the city of Hibbing did file in a timely fashion. It was the Relief Association that didn't file, and that was a result of the president who had the bad back issue and was taking medication and then resigned and then they hired a new president, and then the new president and the old president didn't communicate. And I'm sure filing deadlines were not the
first few things on their minds. And the reason we have this before you is because the statute does say upon demonstration by a relief association of hardship or inability to conform, extend the deadline for reports under subdivision 1A or 1A. Now that one says beyond November 30th, not beyond November 30th. Well, because of what happened with the president of the Relief Association and not getting the forms in before November 30th, the city of Hibbing didn't qualify for the Relief Association money. And so the request is that that this is a demonstration of hardship or inability to conform by the Relief Association and just make one exception one time for this particular situation.
And Senator Thompson, you say this has been rectified and this isn't going to happen again because a town of 17,000, I could see it for the little town.
The town of 17,000 conformed correctly. It was the Relief Association that is associated with the city of Hibbing that didn't conform. The forms are all in, as far as I know, and if this bill were to pass, then the exception would be made for the city of Hibbing and this Relief Association.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen, further?
I'm fine, thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Chairman, is this the only example of a municipality which has both professional and volunteer, or are there other ones like that?
Mr. Martin, or?
Members, Representative Kahn, I can think of at least two others. Red Wing and Austin have, and also Albert Lee comes to mind, okay. At least three.
Seems we should.
Representative Kahn.
Well, but this hasn't happened before where one has done it and one hasn't done it. Seems we ought to send out a notice. To the professional.
Senator Tomasoni indicates that the city filed
its
report. I'm not sure exactly what report that is. These reports are jointly filed, as I understand them.
Yeah.
I'm not sure exactly what the city did file or didn't file. They're supposed to countersign the report that the Our Relief Association files. So I'm not sure what that means. Maybe Senator Tomasoni would like to clarify. Where this tends to happen, Hibbing was a town that had a local paid fire pension fund, and it eventually started to phase out in the late 70s or 1980, and just as PERA covered firefighters now, and some of these towns, when they had a relief association, it covered both the paid and the volunteer with divisions. And then when the paid folks essentially all retired or whatever, then only the volunteers are left, and it's a remnant group, or it's been set up to augment what used to be the local Our Relief Association, local fire department, what it did. That's where these things tend to pop up.
Representative Kahn.
You know, we've been talking, maybe we should have done this while Representative McFarland was still sitting here, who's been working on all of these cooperatives and so forth. Are we doing any motions to get less than those 755 volunteer fire associations? And are there any advantages in cooperation and coordination?
Summer project.
Representative Kahn, members, the legislature did 2 years ago establish the statewide volunteer fire pension plan, and it is getting a handful of member municipalities. There's a once per year enrollment that occurs that will reduce to some degree the 700 plus volunteer fire pension funds. Beyond that, there are only carrots and sticks, and at the moment the legislature has produced the carrot of the statewide plan and no sticks, as I identify them.
Mr. Chairman.
To the point here, Auditor Otto, when both a city and an association has to file a report, if only one does and the other doesn't, is there a mechanism then for catching that, or do you declare that even what has been submitted is not valid because the other has not?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question. And they're, you know, Austin and Albert Lee or Red Wing, I think, whatever, they're all a little bit different than this situation. In this situation, Hibbing, all they have to do, the city only had to file a fire equipment survey form. The majority of the reporting burden is on the fire relief. So they only had, the city had one small, very, very small piece. So really the majority of the reporting is coming from the fire relief. And so it's not that they're doing redundant reporting, because I certainly don't like that. But they're a, somewhat of a unique situation. So, but again, there's a lot of communication that goes on, and you know, things do happen sometimes in local governments. We see it, but and we're neutral on this bill again. You know, Mr. Martin has his memo, but I'm just trying to help you with the details that we know. So,
well, we have to be a little tolerant when it comes to volunteers, but. Hopefully we've got systems that will help them along in that process.
Right.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I move that we hold this House File 1415 and Senate File 1129 over for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Pappas.
I just want to announce that I can't vote on this because I was born in Hibbing, and it's a confidence. That they're glad to get rid of you so you can.
Now, are you going to tell us that you're related to Bob Dylan, too?
Close personal friend.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley.
I'd just like to voice the same concerns on this one as I did in the past one. Number three, the precedent. This would be, again, the first time we're doing something like this.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Daley. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Codd.
Well,
Senator Daley.
You know, I'd feel a little more comfortable, I think, with this if there was a little penalty associated with it. Can't we have a late fee or something like that that goes on to these? To stop. I mean, I don't want to figure that out tonight, but before we do it, include it in the omnibus bill. Isn't that something we could think about?
Probably a good question for us to think about. You bet. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my concern here is seeing this significant kind of pattern and issues. And we already have current state law that allows for, you know, if they miss one filing and then they have these opportunities. Those are already in there. And, you know, I think this is going to need a significant amount of effort to deal with this. But I just have this concern because I'm seeing this pattern. Whenever you do that, and then you just kind of wave the wand of extending a deadline, what it does is to all the other 700 or so who are also volunteers and who did do it, I just have a concern about what it says to them. And so I'm glad to hear that we'll maybe have some further discussion or Representative Kahn some other kinds of issues to deal with. But this is very different to me than some of the other ones we have dealt with.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I've resisted before, but I'm going to say this, too. We do get, when they send out the notices of your tardy, they send the state legislator, the state representative, and the state senator a copy of that. And I've always taken it upon myself when I receive one of those, and maybe I've received three in the last 10 years, I call the person and say, what's going on? And do you realize you're going to lose your money if you don't get your forms in? Mm. That seems to work pretty well. And they've sent them out. We get the copy.
Yep.
So if we do that, we help. We can help the situation along.
It's a good reminder, Representative Murphy. Thank you for that. Thank you, Representative Moline and or Senator Rosen.
And to that point, there are some cities that just don't have the manpower, too, and that refuse it. But this one, I'm hoping that there is some kind of situation in place that this for, I mean, it's quite a large city that should be coordinating here along the way. And so I, too, am a little uncomfortable with why this, it got lost in the shuffle. And yes, it's a, you know, the operations and all that, but still, it just seems like there's more manpower there to have caught it. But if we can continue on the discussion, I would appreciate it.
Chairman, Senator Rosen, it won't happen again.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni and Representative Moline.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, can I just clarify one point?
Yes.
That Mr. Martin had made about how this would possibly include the other cities to the Maple View and Mackinac. I did speak with the auditor, and they did not get their paperwork in by April 30th, so this would not apply to them. This literally would only apply to the city of Hibbing.
Oh, well, that's, Mr. Chairman, that's just because we wrote the legislation to do that. I mean, I don't, you know, everything we do in pensions is kind of like being a little bit pregnant. So so it's, you know, that's why I'd like to think about putting some kind of penalty in this. Losing the whole payment seems a little stiff, but, you know, I wouldn't mind having us figure out some kind of reasonable
penalty. We will revisit that issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll move to our last bill, House File 1528, Senate File 1277, Representative Morrow and Senator Sharon.
Wow.
Welcome to the commission.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for your patience of sitting here until
10 o'clock. I appreciate the chance to appear in front of the commission. I have not been here before. Anyway, I'd like to just orient you a little bit to what we're planning to present. Representative Morrow is going to offer a context to help the commission understand the environment out of which this proposal is being presented. The second thing I'd like to do is, I would ask Mr. Martins if he would prefer to review his comments or if I should first offer the amendments that we have prepared for the bill, which we could do second, and then we can discuss the overall consequences of that in terms of what we're proposing to you and then have discussion.
Okay, why don't you go ahead and present what you would like to share with us first.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. On March 22nd, MnDOT worker Mike Strzok was part of a crew that went out to Highway 169 in Nicola County. They were sent there to clean out a culvert that was blocked, threatening flooding of Highway 169 between St. Peter and Mankato. As part of that operation, Mike Strzok was operating a backhoe. As he was operating the backhoe flipped into the flooded waters, swept him away, causing his drowning death. Mike Strzok was a 9-year employee of MnDOT. Mike has a surviving spouse and 2 children aged 6 and 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With us this evening are Dave Bergstrom, who is the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System, and Peter Watson, who is the General Counsel in the Office of the Governor, available to answer questions and clarify issues for us. As the original bill was presented, we've received feedback from a number of persons from the, including from the Minnesota State Retirement System and Larry Martin, who's the executive director, as you know, of this Commission on Pensions and Retirement. And as a result of that, we've created 4 amendments that we would like to introduce to the bill at this time, if that is your preference. I've organized these in the order of the bill so that if you want to make corrections on the bill, you'll be able to do that in order. The first amendment that we would like to introduce is the 1A amendment.
Mr. Chairman?
What?
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, before we hear the amendments, I guess I'm not sure exactly what you're asking for.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. As you heard, the context that what has happened is that there's been a death of an employee of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And he is a part of the Minnesota State Retirement System. But the retirement system is set up in a way that doesn't anticipate or provide adequately for an early death. It is a program that really is designed to help people set aside dollars, have those dollars managed, and create a pension benefit for them in their retirement. And it doesn't really create an adequate response as someone if someone is younger and earlier in that process and is killed in the line of duty, so to speak, as a result of a violent or aggressive accident when that employee is doing the public's good and public service. That's the unique thing that has happened to the Strzok family, that this young man was clearing the culvert, as Representative Morrow indicated, and the backhoe tipped over. He was aggressively grabbed and pulled under immediately, aggressively, by a very difficult water situation, leaving the family in a difficult situation. So he's in a retirement program that doesn't adequately address a very unique and very unusual circumstance of dying from a violent death while trying to do something to protect the safety of the general public. If he had typically moved through the retirement system, worked for his full 20, 30 years, then the system would work for him. But it doesn't work for a family with a young death and a young family. So that this bill is a proposal for how to respond to that very unique and individual situation. Does that help clarify the question? We can go through what the bill actually does.
I'll wait until Mr. Martin explains it.
No. I mean, I can explain the bill, but we are making amendments to it, so it's a matter of which you want to go first, the chicken or the egg.
Well, we'll let you present the amendments. Senator Sharon and Representative Morrow, I think obviously this is the kind of situation that we as state officials would like to do what we can to provide some relief to this family situation, very tragic situation. I think the question before us is, to what extent should the pension system be used to accomplish that, or are there other ways in which we as a state of Minnesota ought to respond? I think that's the issue that's before us here, and we will hear this out. So, Representative Morrow.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to add on to what Senator Sharon said, what happened was the first reports were that the Strzok family was going to receive a pension payment of $193 a month or so. And there was concern from the governor and others that this was felt to be inadequate. This bill was drafted. After drafting, we started finding out even more about what the complete package was, and that may be what you're about to hear, the complete package of funds that would go to Mike Strzok's widow and to his two children. What this bill is an effort to do, and we'll talk about the amendments, is to make the family whole. But again, that's the context. That's what gave rise to the bill, was there was a perception that the original pension payment was going to be inadequate.
Understood. You may proceed with the amendments.
Thank you. The first amendment is the 1A amendment.
Members, if I could, this is on page 11 of the packet on this item. This is correcting what I think is a drafting ambiguity. This clarifies that the benefit that's being created here is a surviving spouse benefit, and that it's payable for the lifetime of the surviving spouse. Which the problem, without making this unduly complicated, is the bill, if you look on page 17 of the bill, it makes this additional benefit, notwithstanding section 352.12, which would clarify, would specify that it's a surviving spouse benefit payable for life. So since we've not withstood a general law, we need to make sure that some of the normal things that apply to a benefit apply to this. And so it's my understanding this was intended to be for a benefit for the spouse and is measured by the spouse's lifetime.
Representative Kahn.
I don't know if this is traditional or not in any of these things. Well, there is any time where these benefits cut off if the surviving spouse remarries?
Mr. Martin.
Representative Kahn, members, once upon a time, if we roll back far enough. Yes, there was a remarriage discontinuation of survivor benefits, especially in our basic plans. That was done away with 10 or 15 years ago, if memory serves me right. Once upon a time, I think when these originally were formulated in the 1950s, the recipient had to be dependent, and when dependency ended, and remarriage would have been one of those terminations of dependency, that was a requirement, and when dependency ended, the benefit ended. But we have moved away from that. We don't require the proof of dependency, and we don't cancel benefits on remarriage.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I thought these benefits, well, you can certainly get married after 62, I suppose. Is that correct, Senator Sharon, that this would, these benefits would kick in after the age of 62 for this spouse?
Yes, this.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. We will address those issues as we move through, but that is correct, that the workman's compensation benefits and the children's Social Security benefits are first exhausted before this kicks in.
Okay.
And somewhere around the age of 60.
Okay. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, before we start, and I don't mean to be rude or anything, but does any of our pension plans provide for some kind of relief
survivor's
benefits, or relief in this in a situation similar to this?
Mr. Martin?
Or is this the first time we've...
Representative Murphy, members, our pension plans do provide survivor coverage. It's more extensive survivor coverage with basic plans, the plans that do not have Social Security, where the pension coverage is the only survivor coverage provided beyond work comp, if that's applicable. One of the attachments, attachment A to this memo, which is on page 5, talks about the growth of, or the change in survivor benefit coverage for our coordinated members. Before 1971, we only had a death refund. In 1971, there was a creation of the first death while eligible survivor benefit, that where we treat the surviving spouse of someone who had the misfortune of being old enough to retire but didn't file their application to retire on the day before they died. So we treat them as if they had. It was back in 1993 that a similar circumstance, a coordinated member died while in active service, and there was no benefit coverage because they were younger. They didn't qualify for the death while eligible survivor benefits. The commission pondered that, did a study over the interim, the 1992-93 interim, and created in 1993 the current coordinated member survivor benefits. In this case, it's $190-some per month, but prior to the 93 change, it was a death refund. It was a refund of member contributions only from the pension fund. We do provide benefits. If your question is, do we provide benefits of this scale, of this magnitude, we do for our basic programs. This the 54% of high five is, as I understand it, loosely based on what a state trooper who died in the line of duty would get. That's a basic program, not a coordinated program. So there are two questions. Do we provide this kind of coverage? And the answer is yes. It's been a developing part of pension law. Do we provide? It's always been there for basic members, has been developing in the coordinated plans with Social Security. Do we provide this level of benefit only in basic programs, not in coordinated programs? And specifically, this is an additional benefit. The normal MSRS general survivor benefit will be payable immediately. $190-some benefit will be paid. This is an additional benefit that starts in the future when other benefits shut down. And that's unique to have a recipient of two benefits at the same time.
And
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Morrow, then you're bringing this to us because of the youth of the couple. Mm-hmm. And the two young children.
Representative Moore.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to have some testimony from the MSRS
yes.
people?
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
I want to talk about this a lot, or listen to about this a lot tonight. But I would like to move that we hold this over for further discussion. And I'd like that here now so that we can listen carefully and still know there's another opportunity for extensive questions as we think about the answers that we got tonight.
Representative Murphy, are you suggesting a tabling of this? And are you?
I think, Mr. Chair, what I'm suggesting is sometimes when we hold things over for possible inclusion, it goes right into the pile mm-hmm. for possible inclusion, and then we don't discuss it again until we've got the whole bill together. And I think maybe this should be on the agenda again next week, maybe both days. Because I'm saying that because of the experience that we had not a few years ago, that was had some similarities. And I never quite felt that we had talked that all the way through and with the principals, and we might have to even make recommendations to be discussed in the pension plans with pension plan boards for them to make recommendations back to us for situations in the future.
Well, Representative Murphy, what we could do is we could table this for further consideration. I guess the question I would have then is, do you want to consider the amendments now or yeah. with the further discussion?
I think, Mr. Chair, I think if the members would allow us time to have the overview, certainly, and all the people that are prepared to talk about this, we can listen. And but there's going to be more questions than what we have tonight.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's premature to take an action on an amendment when you need more discussion. And I think that seems to be something that I think might be better until we actually have a good discussion than taking action before we're thoroughly informed.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Pappas.
I guess I feel the opposite, that if the authors have already decided to amend their proposal, that it would make more sense, like their author's amendments, not staff-suggested amendments, that we would put the amendments on. Then we know what the actual proposal is when we're discussing the actual proposal.
Senator Pogelman.
That's what I think. Let the authors get it in the shape they want.
Yeah. Is that acceptable?
That's fine with me. Yeah. That's fine with
me. And Representative Murphy, a tabling motion would be in order if But if we get the amendments put on so that we know what is the shape that the bill wants to be in.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
So the plan is to adopt amendments after we discuss these amendments, because I do have quite a few questions on this 5A one. Then we will have a discussion about the bill and then table it? Or are we just going to adopt and table?
Well, I think what Representative Murphy, if I understand correctly, is suggesting that with the discussion that we put the amendments on and then table this and put it on the next agenda. Is that what you're...
Mr. Chair, put the amendments on or not. I mean, maybe we'll put some on or not.
Okay.
Or maybe we want to hold one over and not another.
Okay.
And then continue with the discussion, knowing that it's going to come on another agenda the next time for... in case we want to make an addition to an amendment that was on or another amendment next week or whatever.
Okay, well, let's consider the amendments
Mr. Chairman.
And, yes, Representative Kahn.
I'd also like to hear from Mr. Bergson tonight.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
Absolutely. But let's hear their amendments first and
act on
those. Senator Sharon.
I appreciate the discussion, and it really is our intention through these amendments to get the bill in the form that we can discuss it with you rather than saying that that's not really what we're going to do. We're going to do something else. So if we can get the amendments on, we can go back and then tell you what the bill does, and you can decide about it. So the first one that I need someone to offer for us is the 1A amendment.
I'd offer it. I'd offer it.
Senator Pogamiller moves the 1A amendment. Senator Sharon, you want to speak to that?
Thank you. This is the amendment that Mr. Martin was referring to that adds some specifying language that it refers specifically to surviving spouse and that the benefit is payable for the lifetime of the surviving spouse. So it clearly defines what it is that we're talking about and for whom the benefit is given.
Question about the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, if we're going to respect the fact that the author wants to get the bill in the shape it is, we usually take a little different approach that we just say to the author, put the bill in the shape you want it, rather than, you know, I feel like we're put in this awkward situation of deciding one by one amendments when the whole point is let the author get the bill in the shape they want it. And it might just save a little time if we just allow them to do that. I mean, I don't think this precludes us. My understanding is that once it is and we have the discussion, I would just want to be clear that just because we're allowing you to do that does not mean we're precluded from future actions subsequent to that. It's just a matter of courting you the respect to do that as we are usually doing in the legislature, if that's appropriate for this committee.
Yes, I think it is important for us to vote on the amendment. And so all in favor of the 1A amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carried.
Thank you. Thank you. The next is the 6A amendment.
6A. Does everybody have that? That was not in your packet. That was added.
I'd move the 6A.
Senator Pogamiller moves the 6A amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Do you have the 6A amendment? You can read through it. It indicates that on this first page, line 13, before the colon, we would like you to insert more clarifying language to help describe the uniqueness of this particular proposal, that it's not a general application. And the language states that an eligible person is a person who is a state employee who suffered a violent death while performing assigned duties responding to a flood emergency and then continues on with the rest of the language under 1, 2, and 3.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question for Senator Sharon to get a clarification on what is violent. Is there something in statute? Is there, I mean, that's...
Senator Sharon.
This is a, I would have to defer to the council who recommended this, but it's describing, what we're trying to do is describing here a unique and aggressive situation that is different than somebody simply dying in the course of walking up the stairs to get to their job or going over to the copier, you know, to get a cup of coffee, that we're talking about the death that's related to a very aggressive action against the person, outside the person, while in the act of performing assigned duties, responding to a flood emergency. It's quite narrow.
Senator Rosen.
The flood emergency definitely narrows that. But it also could be we could really get into the weeds on this, but a state worker who's walking on the side of the road and is hit from behind, that would be, is that violent? And they're working on a flood? To me, that would apply. But it's not, I don't know. I'm a little confused about the language.
And they're working on a flood?
Senator Dern.
Thank you. If they are hit by a car on the side of the road while they're trying to resolve a flooding situation to protect the public safety, that may well be. But the reality is this is a very rare kind of an incident. They also, you have to read further here, Senator Rosen, have to meet not only that criteria, but they have to be born on November 7th. They have to be working for the state as of September 25th, 2002, and killed on March 22nd. So it's an accumulation of descriptors.
Well, wow.
But we did want to slim. We did in this language want to speak to the fact that we're talking about a situation in which a person is I guess the term is aggressively, violently situation while working for the public safety in a flooding situation. I mean, this backhoe flipped into rushing water where he was trying to pull carcass out from underneath the cul-de-sac. So, all right.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just take a opportunity here to maybe address, I see three things going on in the amendment, Senator Rosen, and I'm going to work backwards. One, what's the event? And we had talked about using responding to a public safety need. We tried to figure out different ways to deal with the event. And that's when we narrowed it even further, having read the memo about precedent, setting precedent. That's where we went to flooding. I'm not going to go to the second one of performing assigned duties. The person is being required to be at that event to perform those duties. And then we were talking about the third element, which was what caused the death. And we were working through, well, someone could be working at the flood, doing their assigned duties, and die of a condition that's not associated with the event. They just happen to be at the event doing their assigned duties. Yeah. So we're trying to get around the idea. So, for example, someone even may have a heart attack, but that heart attack may not be caused by doing their assigned duties at the public safety event. Whether it's the word violent, whether the commission has another word that works better, I'm certain we would be. We're trying to tie the death being caused by doing the dangerous work, in part because we're looking forward to addressing the concerns about precedent, that we want public workers to know when they go into these dangerous situations, if they're killed as a result of the danger, that their family will be taken care of. So that we're trying to tie together the dangerous event causes the death, and they were required to be in that situation.
Senator, Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is, you know, one of the things that we've done, and I always remember that we get into trouble, and I never remember if we corrected them again, but we used to have the issue of police officers killed in the line of duty. Mm-hmm. And we had then the problem of people who had heart attacks late in life or something, and that was said that that was then related to the line of duty. But clearly what we're doing in this bill, so you don't really need this, because when you put the other stipulations in, we've done the usual thing where we're applying it to just one person, but trying to act as if we're not applying it to just one person.
Mr. Chairman.
And so, what?
Mr. Chairman.
Oh.
To that point?
I think what's going on here is there's an attempt to draft this bill in a way so that future legislatures will be able, and the legislature adopts this, future legislatures can look at all the special circumstances to deny future ones.
Well,
if it chooses. That's what I think the authors have been advised.
Yes.
That the only way that they have a chance, I haven't talked to the authors about this.
Yeah.
I've just, in the past, this is what has happened.
Right.
The advice is draft this really, really tightly, and then somebody else, when they come in 5 years from now, the legislature has the opportunity to say, well, was it a violent death? Was it this? Was it that? Was it that? That's what this attempt is to do right now. I'm not saying whether this is a good idea or not, but I think that's the authors are following legal advice to try to put this in a condition where they can convince us that this isn't going to happen very often. And you've got good reasons to turn down future examples if you need to.
Mm-hmm.
That's all that's going on right this moment.
Okay. Well,
Representative Kahn, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, well, my problem with this is that I'm not sure that, you know, just what happened is that this death got a lot of publicity. And so, in a sense, what happens is if a reporter decides to write a story, that's what determines it. I'm not sure. DOT employees, now, looking at it, you know, there's been a number of DOT employees' deaths while they're on duty. And some of them, the ones I've heard about because we passed the law and a policeman yelled at me for not doing it quite. We're supposed to go over a lane when there's a police car stopped and a policeman out there. Just try and do that every time when you're in traffic and see what happens. But but the point is people get killed. People get killed, you know, officers get killed because they're standing by a car giving a ticket. We now have this wonderful bill that the House has passed. I don't know if the House has passed. The Cornish bill on the shoot first bill. So if someone is in their car now and an officer comes up to them or a DOT person comes up to them, to see if they're in trouble, and they decide they're being invaded in their car, and they can pull out their gun and shoot them, is that considered a violent death? We've just authorized that. It's in process of being authorized.
Is that
a violent death?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
So the point is, I understand how tight this is. But what I'm saying is if we do it, is it appropriate to do it this time? And you also know from having been on the Pension Commission in the past that someone will then come in and argue exactly as I'm arguing that a death while you're standing by the side of a car and a vehicle swerves into you is just as violent as being pulled into a flood. So,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogamiller.
I thought what we had been discussing is just let the authors get the bill in the shape they want. And you're still discussing the merits, which is fine. I just was trying to get the bill in the shape the authors wanted. But the merits, I'm not even talking about the merits. I'm just saying.
All right. Okay. You're right.
Okay. Further discussion on the amendment, the 6A amendment.
Somebody,
did
Mr. Chair, did somebody move
this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, we're working the anchors
off there. Who moved it? Pogamiller moved it. Senator Pogamiller's motion. He's trying to move it along. All in favor of the 6A amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Well, I'll try another one. This is the 5A amendment.
I'd move the 5A amendment.
Thank you, Senator Pogamiller.
Senator Pogamiller moves the 5A amendment.
This amendment changes on line 1.2 in the first page the percentage from...
Senator, I think we can read it. Let's just move it.
Okay, so... okay,
we get it.
Just... Is it?
Yeah. Okay. Question about the 5A.
Because they're going to grow.
Hearing none, all in favor of the 5A, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
And the final
carried.
Amendment
5A
is...
5A is adopted.
Is the 3A amendment?
I'd move the 3A, Mr. Chairman. Oh, I withdraw that. Senator Daley wants to move.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that.
Senator Daley moves the 3A amendment. Question. All in favor of the 3A amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried.
Then, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogamon.
Could I request when it is on the agenda next time that we have an engrossed version?
Yes.
Thank you.
We will have an unofficial engrossment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Can we hear from David Bergstrom?
Senator Sharon.
I know that you wanted to hear from Mr. Bergstrom, so
yes.
he'll be coming. But while he does, I just want you to know that these amendments are responsive to some of the things that you have been talking about. The percentage, for example, is a recognition that this was originally based on the State Patrol that did not account. It's a pension program that does not, is for persons who do not contribute to Social Security. And because that's a difference, we've changed this percentage to 34% so that in the end, that the outcome for the spouse is not different than or excessive or beyond what would occur for other employees in this retirement system.
Okay. Mr. Bergstrom, welcome.
Mr. Chairman,
Give us your words of wisdom.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom. Wisdom goes out of my brain at 10, but I'll do about the best that I can, so if it ever was there. Let me just back up a little bit. To explain currently that Ms. Strzok is eligible for $191 a month payable for her lifetime, and that will increase by 2% a year adjustment. So she is receiving $191. Workers' compensation and Social Security will provide much of the replacement income until those benefits stop in roughly 28 to 30 years, depending on how long it takes the students to get to college. But roughly, you have those two sort of safety nets providing the income over those next few years. What the bill then does provides, at when those workers' compensation benefits end, an additional payment from the Minnesota State Retirement System. The additional payment based on the amendments you adopted would be $2,142 a month. And the present value of that, because of the delay, there's such a long time before it gets paid, is roughly $38,000. So under the amendments you adopted, it would pay $2,142 a month, starting roughly anywhere between when Ms. Strzok, who is currently 30, is age 58 or 60, it would then pay that. And the present value that we would need to set aside today, assuming 8.5% interest, would be $38,000.
Mr. Bergstrom, the 2142, is that in addition to the 191 or
Mr. Chair,
inclusive of the 191?
Mr. Chair, it's in addition to the 191.
Okay. Representative Kahn.
Has any thought that we could look at providing that present day value? It's kind of like making people pay the actuarial cost and maybe making the Department of Transportation pay it.
Right.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, MSRS would love that. It's really a policy decision that the committee would have to make, and I have not been in contact with the department.
Mr. Chair, that is precedent in here, if I read correctly, right, Mr. Bergstrom, that previous situations like this on page 3, section 6.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Am I misreading that?
Mr. Chair, this is the first time it happened for the Minnesota State Retirement System. And I am not clear. Maybe Mr. Martin can help. What happened in the – sounds like there's a case with PERA.
Members, there are two instances that are referred to here. One was an actual enactment. The other was a commission action. The Donald Juneman case was a PERA member, a basic member, who was a St. Paul city inspector who was killed by an irate homeowner. He was just shy of the rule of 90, and the legislature deemed him to be qualified for the rule of 90, which increased his surviving spouse benefit by one or a couple of hundred bucks per month, if I remember correctly. The other is the David Day legislation as recommended by the Pension Commission, which was he was a former St. Louis Park police officer who was serving in the military in Iraq and was killed in Iraq. The Juneman legislation, we required the city of St. Paul to pay the actuarial value of the additional benefit that was provided by deeming the person rule of 90 eligible, and we also recommended, but it was not the ultimate legislation, that St. Louis Park pay the cost of the David Day benefit.
And Mr. Bergstrom, to reconfirm, MSRS has never had a situation like this?
Mr. Chair, in our general plan, no. Our state patrol does provide a minimum benefit, and that's what the authors are trying to do, is somewhat duplicate what our state patrol plan has offered. But we have never had a special provision for our general employees' retirement.
Senator Pogon.
Chairman, if the staff could, I believe the Juneman one did pass through the commission. The commission agreed with it. Yeah. The David Day one, the commission got run over by the House and the Senate. The commission had turned down the David Day one.
Senator, members, yes. The Juneman was recommended by the Pension Commission, was part of an omnibus pension bill. The David Day was over a couple of years that was floating. The only time that the commission recommended it was with local municipal payment of the cost of the benefit. The ultimate passage of that, which was part of special legislation and appropriations bill not related to pensions, had a general redefinition of the PERA, police and fire, non-duty disability to change the vesting for individuals who are in active military service, which was made retroactive to include the David Day situation.
But, Mr. Chair?
Without any employer payment.
Yeah. Representative Murphy, was either one of those instances the one you were referring to?
Yes.
Yes,
Mr. Chair.
That's what I thought.
This one instance. And also in the Day situation, if my memory serves me, I don't believe that the spouse was designated as a beneficiary. The father was. And then the father came before, or the father brought the issue to the legislature.
The person involved was not eligible for a non-duty death benefit. Only a death refund was payable. He had been married for such a short period of time, he had not changed his beneficiary designation, so his parents were still designated as the recipients of the death refund benefits. The special or the legislation that passed as part of the Agriculture and Natural Resources Appropriations Bill would made the spouse eligible for a non-duty disability or non-duty death benefits.
As if he still.
And it was not payable by the employing unit that was involved for St. Louis Park, but it was paid out of the PERA plan.
Yes. And
Representative Murphy.
Back to that point, and then I have another question relating to Representative Kahn's question about can't we get DOT to pay it? And then this afternoon I thought, was this employee paid from DOT's funds that they get from the general fund? Was he working? as an employee who DOT pays the salaries from the general fund, or was he one that gets paid for from public safety funds? Because the public safety funds are designated, whereas was he a general fund employee?
Mr. Bergstrom, do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair, I do not know what fund he was paid from. And I could call and find out, but as of this point, I do not know.
That's a need for another
bit of information
where we
okay.
discuss things.
Representative Kahn, are we getting close to
yes, just
tabling?
One finishing yes. up the day, finishing up the day story. Didn't we repeal that general thing so that it only, the next year we came back and repealed that, so that it only applied to this. We couldn't take away, we didn't take away the benefit from this one person, but we did make sure it wasn't part of the general law. It shows the problems of doing things on the floor of the House instead of through the Pension Commission.
Mr. Martin?
Members, that is correct. The in a subsequent session, the provision that was added to the PERA police and fire plan was changed. It was no longer defined to include non-duty military-related deaths.
Right. Representative Murphy, do you wish to make your motion at this point?
Mr. Chair, I move.
Was there anybody else that wanted?
Is anyone else
testimony you can't be here the next time?
Is Ms. Blyle here? I didn't see. She is? Okay, well, I didn't see you back there. Yes. Will you please give us your name for the record? And
thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the commission. I'm Julie Blyle, legislative director for AFSCME Council 5. Mike Strzok was one of our members, DOT members, and we did communicate with Ms. Strzok that the hearing would take place this evening. And they were unable to make it to the hearing, but they've asked that we inform them as to the status and the next step in the process. So we would like to go on record in support of the benefit for Ms. Strzok. This situation is unique in my time here at the legislature. We've not had a member in this type of situation. He literally gave his life in the line of work. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, I move we table House File 1528, Senate File 1277.
Okay, all in favor of tabling that for consideration at a subsequent meeting, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. Members, before you depart, let me just tell you a couple of things that you can be thinking about. We're set for Wednesday evening, the 11th, at 6:30, and we've also tentatively scheduled a meeting on Thursday, which could be either late afternoon or evening, depending on House and Senate schedule as it evolves for next week. And then, as I mentioned, we asked you, too, if the evening of the 16th, a week from Monday, if that could be our target for approving any omnibus bill that we wish to consider. And then the other thing I want to mention is I've talked with Mr. Martin. We're going to be working on the agenda for next week, and we'll have that out on Monday morning so that all of you will know. And if you've got any particular concerns about other bills that are on the docket, let me know so that we can get things scheduled for next week. And then I'd like you to be thinking about, I would like to have us, before we adjourn this session, to identify four dates, two maybe next fall, two January, February, where we could have the better part of a day to dig into some of the bigger issues that we need to address as a commission. And so I wanted to mention that to you. I'm thinking a date maybe in September, one October, early November, then again January, February, so that when we enter next session, we will have some good possibilities of things that we want to pursue as a commission. So I wanted to mention that to get you thinking about it. Hopefully we can set some dates before we finish out this session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, too, on the omnibus policy or something like that, when would a draft staff, you're thinking, that would that just come out with a board packet or commission packet prior to the meeting?
Well, our goal would be to have that out before the 16th.
Members, what I would anticipate doing is, in addition to doing an unofficial engrossment of the last bill that you looked at, we would also take the other bills that you looked at tonight and fold them together in what would be the omnibus bill if you choose to ultimately approve them, so you can see them with all amendments.